Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Wednesday, more than 70 media organizations in the Bay Area came together for a day of coordinated coverage of the homeless problem in San Francisco. And on KALW and many other news outlets, that day ended up being a full week of coverage. The San Francisco Chronicle jump-started the effort and has been aggregating stories from all these different providers of news in the Bay Area and asking readers to engage in the conversation and propose their solutions to what can often seem like an intractable problem. This project called the SF Homeless Project, has created an unprecedented level of coverage of homelessness in the Bay Area this week. And it's also led a lot of people to question and critique the ways that homeless people are portrayed in the media and how we define this problem. What does it mean to do solutions-oriented reporting? What kind of journalistic work actually helps make change? And is that the role reporters should play? Is there the will and the resources to do the in-depth, long-term reporting that can hold government officials and the myriad nonprofits who work with the homeless accountable? We want to hear what you thought of the media focus on homelessness this week, what impressed you, what you learned, what could have been done better, what you think is problematic about the way that homeless people and the roots of homelessness are reported on. Did it spark conversation among you and your friends and neighbors? If you saw some great reporting this week, please let us know. You can post a comment at yourcallradio.org. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or, of course, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. This week on the Media Roundtable, we're joined by three journalists who cover homelessness and urban poverty week in and week out. First from Los Angeles, Gail Holland. She is an award-winning investigative journalist, a staff writer with the LA Times, who covers homelessness and poverty. Gail, thank you so much for being back on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us. And from up the coast in Seattle, we have Daniel Beekman. He's a Seattle Times staff reporter who covers Seattle city government and local politics and has been looking at homelessness there as well as in other cities in the country. And Daniel, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, here in San Francisco, Kevin Fagan, well-known to readers of the San Francisco Chronicle, longtime reporter there. He's been covering poverty and homelessness for the paper. And from 2003 to 2006, Kevin was the only beat reporter in the country covering homelessness full-time. So, Kevin, you've got a huge amount of background and knowledge about this, and we appreciate having you on the program.
Hey, glad to be here.
So let's start, as we always do, focusing on the positive for a moment before we get to the critique, and that is to ask each of you to bring forward a piece of reporting or analysis from this week. Can be from any journalistic, any source on any subject. We just want to hear you talk about some journalism that's done well this week. Gail, what do you have that you'd like to raise up?
Well, I was fascinated by Kevin's story about solutions to SF's homeless problem. I thought it was very clear and very readable and with some very complex numbers-based reporting, and I was very curious what kind of audience reaction he got.
Kevin?
Oh, it was surprising. I got very good reaction. I did a couple of stories. One was the lead-off, giving a history of homelessness, and I got a few conservatives who said that I blamed Ronald Reagan too much for some of the strip down of affordable housing funding. But the one that I poured probably more of my heart into was the one that ran Wednesday on how to ramp up supportive housing. And that one I really tried hard to use to look at best practices and do some numbers calculations on how to bring up the number of units that we have and how to fund them and what kind of timeline. And I got some really nice reaction with that. Some of Obama's policy leaders said they really liked it nationally, and we're using it as a bit of a template or a talking point, and that made me feel really good. And then locally, some of the people who provide supportive housing said that it was good to see some examination of that. And I've written about supportive housing pretty intensively many times over the years, and this was a really nice opportunity to get the ideas out there.
So, Gail, as someone who tries to report on similar issues in Los Angeles to what Kevin has done in the Bay Area here for years, what was it about the way he approached that article, what he brought to it, that you thought was impressive?
Well, I think that, you know, marshaling the numbers and presenting it as a fix, I'm not quite as confident that they really do know how to fix homelessness than anyone does. But I found it fascinating and very well done, the way he pulled it together, and I certainly wouldn't dispute anything that he wrote in there. I'm very curious to hear what Kevin has to say, because he's covered homelessness so much longer than I, and it's, from what I've gathered, each generation has come up with their idea of a solution, but here we are.
Yeah.
So...
That's really true, and I've watched it. I started covering homelessness when I became a reporter in 1979. So I watched the evolution, and it's first off, there's a poverty problem that continually refreshes the pool. So in it, to some extent, you're bailing out the tide, but it can be bailed. If you get enough momentum toward creating affordable housing with services for people, you can get ahead of the curve. I do believe. I'm an optimist, I've seen people fail horribly. I've written more obits on friends of mine in the street than I care to count, but I've also seen success stories. I think it can be fixed. There needs to be more federal and state attention and funding, of course, but in the meantime, you can make a lot of headway. And this city and L.A. is actually making some good progress
towards
supportive housing.
We will get back to talking about the solutions and the role of journalists in covering them and trying to say, you know, what actually is working and what's not. But maybe you have a piece that you'd like to point to this week that you thought was really well done?
Well, one that really struck me, just as a guy who's been paying attention for a long time, KPIX Channel 5 did a long video clip with interviewing a couple of people who've been involved in homelessness for many, many years. And I thought it was a wonderful look back that took us up to the present time with images dating back to Dianne Feinstein, because you have to go back to the 80s if you're going to try to understand it. I thought that was terrific. BuzzFeed did this terrific tool online where you posit yourself in a homeless situation, and then you make choices. It's kind of like, oh, I don't know, those games that video games that some people play, where you click through to see what happens with each choice you make as you're trying to get yourself stabilized. And it was a wonderful illustration of how amazingly hard it is to pull yourself up once you've really fallen down hard. I thought those two were, in particular, were really good. There was a lot of great stuff. I mean, we had 250 stories on the aggregate website just at sfgate.com. You couldn't even read them all. It was just a ton of really interesting stuff.
Yeah, it's going to definitely take time for people to digest all that was reported this week. And obviously, this is not a discussion that needs to end. It needs to just be the beginning of it. Daniel Beekman, anything that you would point to as really good reporting to this week that you saw?
Sure. Well, it seems like we're on the same wavelength here. The story I was going to mention was actually Kevin's sort of look back at San Francisco's homelessness problem over the years. I just thought it was really well done and valuable. Obviously I'm up here in Seattle, and so I don't know the history in San Francisco. And from trying to write stories like that, just cover decades and complex issues, I know how hard it can be to synthesize all that information and make it clear and tell a story that makes sense. I thought Kevin did a great job and appreciated the historical perspective. I feel like sometimes folks are showing up here in Seattle, and we have a lot of transplants these days, and looking at homelessness as if it's something new, or even people who have lived here a long time treating it as if it's something new and it's come out of nowhere, and that's just not the case. And so I appreciated Kevin's story, and I hadn't seen that BuzzFeed choose your own adventure if you're on the street story, but I just Googled it while Kevin was talking about it, and it looks pretty cool.
That's really That's Daniel Beekman. He's a Seattle Times staff reporter. Also with us, Kevin Fagan from the San Francisco Chronicle and Gail Holland of the LA Times on this week's media roundtable here on Your Call. We're talking about coverage of homelessness, the SF Homeless Project, a collective effort of more than 70 media organizations to bring attention to the causes and solutions of homelessness, focused here in the Bay Area, but not limited to it. And we want to know what you thought of that coverage. If you thought something that you read or saw or heard was impressive that you want to let people know about, give us a call at 866-798-TALK. You can also post comments at yourcallradio.org, which is also where people will be able to find all of the pieces that were just referred to by our guests that they wanted to raise up and say, hey, here's some good work that's going on in journalism right now. And I wanted to follow up just from something that clearly came out of your reporting, Kevin, where you were doing that historic look. And also just from all the conversations we had here on Your Call this week, which is, you know, we cover this as, this is a week focused on homelessness. But in a lot of ways, and especially when you look at federal policy, this is a housing issue, right? When you see that where this crisis really emerges at a time when, as those critics of your piece said, you know, big cuts in the Reagan era to housing and urban development and fundamental changes in the way the federal government dealt with housing for poor people.
Yeah.
To what extent is it a housing story, and does it make sense to kind of separate it out from our kind of broader conversation about housing and the economy?
You can always it's always good to take each topic individually, but I think as a totality, they're interconnected in a way you can't avoid. One of the things about covering homelessness for a long time, in the 80s and the 90s, a lot of the discussion was just very localized, like, oh my God, there are homeless people in the streets. We must give them a sandwich and a cot and a shelter. And then that, as the awareness grew of how entrenched the difficulties are when you've fallen all the way down into the street, an emphasis on supportive housing grew and services. But one thing that advocates in particular have always emphasized is the cuts in the housing and the kind of push down of the poor that has progressed over the decades, and that gets dismissed a lot, like saying, that's macro. No, let's stick on the local issues and what we can do locally. But the macro really does have an effect, and that's one thing I tried to put in my first story. 30% of the country today lives at or near poverty level, which is shocking. Your minimum wage buys half what it did in 1980. And in the 80s, 80% of funding for affordable housing for the poor was eliminated. Now, you can't have that kind of equation and not have a continual fountain of really poor and homeless people. So that has to be addressed as well.
Gail Holland, how do you think about how you cover those two together and how the beats get divided up and that, you know, that affects how the stories are told?
Yeah, I really agree. We recently have another full-time reporter focusing on housing. I think there's so many unintended consequences to so many very well-conceived and well-meaning, even the most well-conceived and well-meaning proposals that have come forward. There was a really fantastic book that came out this year called Eviction. And he talked about the fact that rent subsidies, which is, there's a big focus on that down here as far as getting people, not the chronically homeless that Kevin focused on for the permanent supportive housing, but people who simply can't afford to pay the skyrocketing rents in cities like L.A. and San Francisco to bring them up to market level. He explained how, at least in some cities, those subsidies simply subsidize slumlords. So there's so many different ways to look at the interconnections, and of course that's our job.
Daniel, you want to weigh in?
Sure. I two quick thoughts. One is that, you know, I was thinking about the homelessness and housing. I was down in San Francisco a month or so ago, maybe a little bit more now, with a photographer to do a story on the Mission District Navigation Center, and was writing a lot and talking to people about this sort of model, low barrier model, to bring people off the street and out of encampments, and what was being done in order to accommodate a particular type of street, people living on the street. And that all made a lot of sense. When I got back up here and was talking to people here in Seattle about that model, they said, yes, you know, it sounds good to us. It might help us bring more people off the street, but if we don't have the housing to put folks into on the back end, then it won't really have the effect, the desired effect. And another thing that came to mind was, I think the Seattle's Mayor Ed Murray is really sort of grappling with the question of housing and homelessness right now, and that in November he declared proclaimed a state of emergency over homelessness in the city. Our county executive and the surrounding county did the same thing, and a big part of that was calling for more state and federal funding for affordable housing. You know, he's been beating that drum, but at the same time, people here in the city are looking at him to fix homelessness in the city, and it's gotten really bad. And so that's definitely a tension where he's saying we need more help, but also what do we have to do on the local level?
And I think there's also this question, to the extent there is a federal, you know, there's obviously a big federal component to this, even if it's often a matter of there just isn't the federal presence on these issues that there might be, each of your papers, you know, how many folks do you have in Washington, D.C., and, you know, how much time is there for them to focus on housing policy, right? That may not be considered kind of the top thing that a national reporter should be working on.
Yeah, that is difficult.
I wonder if there are any D.C. reporters whose main portfolio is housing. I would be surprised.
Yeah,
I would too these days with all the, you know, with the shrinking of the industry. Used to have all kinds of beat reporters, but fewer today.
So, Kevin, I wanted to follow up just on something Daniel reported on, which was he did a story, you know, specifically about what he calls these low barrier, approaches getting people in off the streets. And I mean, here we're talking about these things called navigation centers that have been started in San Francisco. And the SF Homeless Project, part of this media push was about really talking about solutions journalism.
Yeah.
And, you know, to talk about, you know, things small and large that seem to really make a difference. I guess my question is about that, you know, whether it's covering the navigation centers, which is a pretty significant effort, or, you know, or kind of really comprehensive approaches or smaller ones, is whether we tend to focus too much on kind of things when they're fresh and new, when they're in their kind of model, you know, mm-hmm. time, when there's lots of attention and more resources than probably are going to be sustainable, and how you avoid kind of falling into the trap of going, oh, here, somebody's got the latest mousetrap to fix homelessness in the way you cover it.
Yeah, shiny object coverage. I try to put as much context as I can into these things. There was a study some years ago at UC Berkeley said if we increased our story length by 20%, we would be able to buy the context that would make them smarter. I found that to be somewhat the case. Navigation centers, like Daniel found, they're great, but they're tools. They're in-betweens. If you don't have the housing on the back end, it's just another shelter with people getting frustrated about wondering where they can go. And I believe I've tried, and my partner at City Hall, who covers this a lot, Heather Knight, has tried also to raise that and to make that a part of our coverage. Because you can't, it's a disservice just to say, oh, isn't this cool, navigation center, but you have to look beyond that. And I know Gail has done, Gail gets that in her poverty coverage in L.A. And I love what Daniel did on, didn't you do something on the jungle just recently up there? That's the symbol of tent cities in Seattle.
Yeah, we've been writing, you know, about sort of serious homeless encampments under and around Interstate 5 up here in Seattle. People call it the jungle. Writing about that, you know, pretty much every week for weeks and weeks and weeks now. A lot of different stories.
You get a symbol like that, and people go, it drives people wild because they're able to focus, and they say, you got to do something. If you broke that camp up and spread it around, the problem would be the same. It would just be less visible. And you know, it's like the navigation center. You put people inside the shelter, it's a little less visible, but you got to give them a permanent place to go.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring listeners into this conversation. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We're taking a close look at coverage of the homeless and the homeless crisis here in the Bay Area and nationwide. And we welcome your calls at 866-798-8255, as well as your emails at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Eileen is calling in from Mountain View. Eileen, welcome to Your Call.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate the attention given to the problems of homeless people. And I didn't hear everything this week, but I would love it if people would talk more about the basic causes of homelessness. I mean, people don't live on farms anymore, and you need money to buy clothes and food and shelter. And almost half of the U.S. population is low income. There's just almost 15% live, that's 45 million people, live on an income of $23,000 for a family of four, and another 33% live at two times the poverty level, and that's $48,000 for a family of four. And imagine trying to live in San Francisco on an income like that. A fifth of the children live in poverty in the United States, while the top 5% own 72% of the wealth. It seems to me that the distribution of income makes it very difficult for people to meet their basic needs. And I'm just amazed there aren't more people on the street. But I do appreciate your coverage, and I wish people would talk a little bit more about some of the basics. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, we got a great opportunity to do it. Thank you so much for the call, Eileen. Gail, do you want to start responding to Eileen there?
Yeah, I think that as she just mentioned, she had at her fingertips the facts about income inequality. I think people know about it. I think what is more valuable in coverage is to look at the money that's being spent to address it and whether it's being well spent. I think that's something journalists can do. I don't know. I think we can look at the lives of poor people, and I think we do, and explain how difficult it is. But I think that as far as being solutions-based, I think it's more worthwhile to look at the money the government is pouring into these programs and what effect and impact they're having. And I have a question in that regard for both of you. There's so much attention in your cities to homelessness. Do you feel that this is, and this project in particular, is creating political will to tackle it in a new way or to take on housing? Or
what do you think, Daniel? Because I certainly have some thoughts down here, but what do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The SF Homeless Project inspired. We had one day, not a full week, but Wednesday this week, we had a Seattle homeless media blitz, where not quite as many organizations outlets as down your way, but we sort of did something similar, and I think it probably boosted awareness. Pretty much all the media outlets here have been covering the homelessness and issues of affordable housing pretty intensely, just because it's, besides congestion, traffic congestion, it's the number one thing that people talk about in Seattle right now. In terms of political will, I think the politicians locally here feel a lot of pressure to do something and to make progress. It's just figuring out how to get there. That's the challenge.
So thank you so much. That's Daniel Beekman. He's the Seattle Times staff reporter who covers city government, local politics there, and has done a lot of reporting on homelessness and poverty. Also with us from the LA Times, Gail Holland, an award-winning investigative journalist covering the same issues, and Kevin Fagan, longtime reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, who was one of the first full-time reporters to focus on the beat of homelessness and the issues surrounding it, the ways to solve it. This is a Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back with more of the conversation after this.
This This is your call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, you're welcome to join the conversation. Our telephone number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock, it's Inflection Point. Stay tuned.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. You can always find more information about our show and resources there at yourcallradio.org. You can also find out what's coming up next. For instance, on Monday, we're going to be revisiting a conversation we had with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice, who is the author of a new book called The Fight to Vote, all about the history of voting rights and current challenges to them here in the United States. Pretty important as we approach a very big election in November. And on Tuesday, we're going to have a conversation with David Talbot, author of the new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David Talbot, always interesting to listen to. You want to tune in on Tuesday for that. We are talking today about coverage of homelessness. There's the SF Homeless Project that was launched by the San Francisco Chronicle, joined in by dozens of other local news organizations and news organizations outside of the Bay Area, shining a light on the causes and also potential solutions for homelessness. And we are interested in your thoughts about the coverage. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org or join the conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Although I will say at the moment, it looks like our lines are full, so they'll open up shortly as we bring folks on. Kevin Fagan with the San Francisco Chronicle, I wanted to return to you, and I want to make sure folks know we also have Gail Holland on from the LA Times and Daniel Beekman from the Seattle Times. But Kevin Fagan, back to this question about what reporting does, you know, in terms of getting public will going, political will behind, you know, solving what's obviously a difficult and to actually really address in a serious way an expensive problem to get on top of. A question I had, I mean, you know, this week, in addition to there being this homeless project by all these media organizations, KALW among them, there is also the launch of a new Department of Homelessness and supportive housing that was launched by Mayor Lee, that actually today is the first day that it's open for business.
Yeah.
And I just wonder what you think. I mean, in a certain sense, somebody might say, well, you know what? This week of coverage of homelessness provides a pretty nice frame for the mayor to say, and look, here's my new department. I've got this great new initiative. Just that, you know, I mean, I understand on one hand, it's like it's a great news hook. You know, those of us in journalism think about, oh, what's a good moment to grab and say, let's shine a light on this. But on the other hand, you might say, hey, this is a great, great week for the mayor to launch a new department. You know, it seems like every mayor in San Francisco, going back to Art Agnos, Dianne Feinstein, has had this kind of initiative. I don't know. I just wonder how you think about, you know, when you are kind of like providing a platform for the politicians and how you hold them accountable.
Yeah, it is an interesting confluence. First off, I think that homeless department launch is coincidental with our barrage of coverage. I mean, I covered the announcement of that thing months ago. And the guy who heads it up, Jeff Kosicki, I've known that guy for 20 years or nearly 20 years. He's going to appreciate. I know he appreciates all the coverage. What I've had, the feedback I've had from city leaders and regional leaders has been nothing but positive. There are a couple little snipes here and there of, you know, you should have put me in or something like that. But people are really interested in solving this. And the political, you know, shenanigans that go on aside, the leaders around here really did like having an attention on it. And I'm passionate about solutions journalism. There's an organization called Solutions Journalism. I helped brainstorm it way back and when it started several years ago. And with Courtney Martin was this young journalist who had the idea, and we talked then about a series I did in 2003 that was solutions oriented, and that series did affect some change. It influenced people to increase supportive housing, street outreach, services to help people get into better situations when they're on the street. And I was very glad for that, and a lot of journalism being done today is trending more toward not just complaining about things, but looking at best practices. I think that's a very useful thing to do, and I think the people in this city that have been reading this barrage of hundreds of stories are appreciating the talking points that it gives them some momentum for some of the best practices, because they can say, hey, look, this stuff got discussed. You know, street outreach, improving it, the navigation centers, assessing them more closely. It's just a whole range of issues that can overwhelm people as the months go by, as the years go by. But having a lot of attention on it helped stir up discussions, useful discussions. I think it's ultimately going to be a really good thing.
Gail Holland, you were talking about the importance of this kind of accountability journalism, which is really saying, hey, how is this money being spent and what kind of impact is it having? In your own work, so what does that look like? What's the work that, you know, what's the kind of footwork you have to do? What's an example of how you kind of really go, hey, this is a way this money's being spent that works, or this is a way that doesn't?
Well, I think you have to, I think it's what we do. We go get the records, we get the pay records, we get the budgets, we get the breakdown of what things really being spent, what money is actually being spent on behind the rhetoric, and then we examine what effect it either is or may have. I know I did a story pretty recently about rent vouchers is one of the big things that the city of LA is putting their money into, but the people in the street who are charged, you know, the social service agencies that are handling the people and trying to help them find the places are finding that there are no places that will take the vouchers.
That was a powerful piece, and I think just when I think people sometimes hear, well, you know, these people have gotten out of a shelter, they've got a housing voucher, and we kind of think, oh, well, problem solved, at least for that individual for that moment. But reading your story, it's very clear, like, no, that can be a revolving door at best sometimes for people. I want to bring in other listeners into the program. We got a call from Samantha in San Francisco. Samantha, welcome to your call.
Thank you. I was just going to say that I attended an event that was put on by the San Francisco Public Press a couple years ago called Hack the Housing Crisis at the Hub. And it was very effective in strategizing ways, you know, as people were becoming like threatened with false evictions here in the city. And I've noticed that a portion of the people that are homeless, you know, maybe they didn't get advocacy, or they just believed that first false 3-day, you know, notice and had to leave. This could have been prevented, you know. And I just wanted to mention that all the people under the South Van Ness Bridge, you know, in the tents that had been kind of evicted, now are dispersed all throughout Potrero Hill, near Rainbow Grocery, everywhere. I mean, we've just relocated people, so that's not really the solution. But I will say, as a native of SF, I thought years ago, how cool would it be, you know, one of those hotels down on 3rd Street, the one that had all of the furniture adhered to the exterior.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
If, like,
building.
That was taken and there were people that were actually very much interested in helping, you know, the underrepresented and the poor and those that have mental illness, and had them, you know, employed there. Hey, we have a garden in the back. Hey, we're running a juice bar. You work for your, you know, your rent, but some sort of preliminary step to prevent homelessness. I don't know. Is there a large facility that can be given and run effectively? We have money to throw at an Oracle Stadium and so many other general hospitals, you know, facade. But anyway, that's my comment.
Kevin Fagan, thank you so much, Samantha.
Samantha, you're right on, and there are programs like that. Episcopal Community Services here runs one called Chefs that trains people for working in the food industry. They also train people for painting and working in construction. There are a lot of, you need to ramp them up, because you're dead right that that is a really good way to help people stay off the street and help people after they've gone into the street. And they're, you know, they're turning those old residential hotels and buildings like the wacky one you mentioned that had all the furniture tacked to the outside. That happens all the time. About 400 units or so get converted every year here in the city. Got to ramp it up. That's the thing.
Daniel Beekman, I wanted to ask you, in kind of doing some comparative reporting to what's happening in Seattle, you came here to San Francisco. You also went to Houston and looked at their approach there. I just would love you to just talk a little bit about what you learned there, and also just the thinking your editors, you know, it's a commitment to send a local reporter, you know, who covers city government, to go across the country and dig into a story. What was that conversation like, and then yeah, what'd you get from making that trip?
Sure, I think that's a good point. And, you know, I was able to go to San Francisco and Houston partly because we had financial help from the organization that Kevin mentioned, the Solutions Journalism. And
yeah,
so that's something that we might not have had the resources to do on our own. So that was important. And it was my sort of first big foray personally into you know, really intentionally solutions-oriented journalism, and it was a good experience for me. You know, not just leaders here, although I think they paid attention to what we did, but I had really good feedback from readers who seemed to be saying, "Finally, you're talking about you know, something that we can do, or some things that work in at least some ways." And we were very careful to explain, give context, and explain that none of these things are perfect, and there are differences between Seattle and other cities, et cetera. But I think readers really like to, you know, average readers really like to see that. But in Houston, it was interesting, you know, compared to San Francisco, where the photographer and I looked at the Navigation Center, this one facility, in sort of a discrete model. In Houston, we're looking more at a whole system, and what the city of Houston and their partners, the county and the housing authorities and nonprofits and funders, et cetera, have done over the last few years to try to work better together and build a coordinated system for moving people quickly from the street into housing, mostly permanent supportive housing. And also building a lot more of that than they had before. So it was kind of a challenging reporting project just because a system across an enormous city and region is harder to get your mind around than one facility on Mission Street. But I think it was worth doing. And the real sort of standout piece of that was just how much Houston leaders say their particularly chronic homeless population has been reduced. I mean, by huge numbers over the last few years.
Yeah, it was impressive.
Their estimates.
Seeing the data. Yeah, so obviously, you have to you know, kind of always be critical of where, you know, where the data comes from and you know what it's based on. But it seemed like incredible progress. Did you get a sense of what actually sparked that city's kind of commitment to that, and maybe what role local media played in that?
You know, I'm not so clear on what role local media played in it. It seemed like things got started under a mayor who had a real commitment to the issue, and also what folks told me down there was there was in around 2011, 2012, a lot of new leaders came into key positions in the area with the housing authorities and other organizations, and sort of all got in the same room and also got connected with the Obama administration, the folks working on homelessness there, and sort of decided, hey, what we're doing isn't working. Let's sort of go for broke on what the feds want us to do, and if we do that, we'll get money from them. And let's just all try this. And it was interesting comparing Houston to Seattle, because folks in Houston said, "Hey, Seattle, your nonprofits are great. They're big. They've been around a long time. You've been doing a lot of interesting things longer than us in Houston." But we almost had an advantage in a way because we started more from scratch. I thought that was an interesting point.
Let's talk to Sam in San Francisco, who's called in to the program. Sam, welcome to your call.
Thank you. First, I'd like to say, in the way of kudos, I think that it was very powerful this week, just even without looking at coverage, and there was no way to look at all of it, just walking down the street and seeing every the front page of every newspaper having something about homelessness, no matter what radio station you tune into, they were talking about homelessness. I think that was very powerful in and of itself. And I would like to also say that I wonder, in the nature of my comment that I want to make, I wonder to what extent we were conflating homelessness with poverty in general. That's something I wonder about. And in the matter of a criticism, I was not able to hear by any means all the coverage this week, just a tiny bit. I listened to KALW a lot. And I wondered about how realistic some of the things addressed as far as what a person who was could do. And in particular, as an example, I heard something on KALW one day this week where they were talking about what do you see someone lying in the street, lying on the sidewalk, you know, to see if they're okay instead of just walking by, which doesn't seem the right thing to do. And I actually was experimenting with that. I saw someone yesterday lying on the sidewalk, all splayed out, and the advice given in the program was, well, can you see them breathing? Do they seem okay? And I saw this man lying like that, and I thought, I'm not going to stand here and look to see if he's breathing. I'm just going to do what I always do, which is to assume, oh, well, you know, there's someone passed out on the sidewalk. And likewise, you know, if there's someone on every corner asking for money, you really can't engage with each one of them. It's not realistic. So I wonder what the panelists have to say about that.
Sam, thanks so much for the call. Kevin Fagan, I mean, obviously, I think people have, homelessness, by the nature of the fact that people are homeless, they're on the streets. All kinds of people, you know, it's like we interact with one another on the street, and there's a real hunger for like a sense of like, what do I as an individual do? And obviously, on the other side of things, for a human response, you know, on both sides of that relationship, I'm sure that people must come to you with these questions and things like that a lot. How do you think about that as a journalist, and how'd you respond to what Sam had to say?
Oh yeah, I do get asked that a lot, and I lived on the streets here for 6 months for one of the series that I wrote, so I've seen it from the other side. People walk by you and they, you know, you feel a lot of derision and hate and pity and a whole range of emotions. I've found that as I interact with people, these are just poor people. They're humans who had a series of really crappy things happen in their lives. Just stop and talk. I mean, you get panhandled a lot. I try not to give out money. I'd be broke if I gave a buck to everyone who asked me. You know, I'll buy people sandwiches, cup of coffee. I probably shouldn't say this, but I actually give cigarettes, which is what a lot of outreach workers do. It's anything to get a conversation going. You don't have to give anything to get a conversation going. Just look at someone like who they are. It's a human being, and people really appreciate someone paying attention to them for a moment as something other than a poor thing in the street. You know, talk about books. You know, how's the weather? You know, what do you think of the traffic? Have a normal conversation. It does a lot. If someone's passed out in the street, hell, I've found some of my homeless, you know, friends, sources dead on the street. You don't know if someone's dead or not. Use your common sense about how you can approach someone who's sprawled out. A lot of times they don't want to be waked up. But the big thing is be kind, have a real conversation, and, you know, live your life.
You know, we talked this week on our program with, you know, we did some live broadcasts from the Tenderloin where we had service providers and homeless people on the program. We talked to Jeff Kosicki, the new head of the Department of Homelessness. We talked to some very powerful advocates this week, and all of them talked about this importance of humanizing people on the streets. I mean, and I think that for journalists, I mean, I think the usual vehicle for that is the, you know, the let's have a profile of a person, tell their story, so it's not just, these aren't abstractions, they're not folks you're just walking by who are lying, who you never talked to, lying down the street that you never talked to. But I also think, it just raised a question for me about that kind of reporting, although it can be really powerful, is also a bit of the low-hanging fruit in terms of the resource intensiveness of it and really, you know, telling the kind of accountability stories like that Gail was talking about, or that you all at the Chronicle were involved in this week, where you're looking longer view. I guess just at this point, where many of these stories have been told, what is there to do in those kind of individual profile stories, or these kind of like what's the human connection between people on the street and the people walking past them, Gail?
Well, I think you have to find, you know, news value. You have to humanize a story that has some news value, so you find a point of conflict or, you know, just traditional news values. I know exactly what you're saying. I know that the shelters in particular here are constantly offering up people with truly inspiring stories, but there's a sameness to them. Although when you meet the people, of course, there isn't. When you meet the people, you find them quite fascinating.
Yeah.
But I think you have to look for some news value with those stories. But at the same time, I think there are stories that are written. The valuable part of focusing on individuals is that there are stories that are written too much from an institutional point of view.
What does that mean?
Where the problem as defined either by social service providers or decision makers, politicians, without actually talking to people who are going to be affected by the policies that are under discussion, because many times their viewpoint provides a very welcome and valuable critical window to look at the policies or suggestions.
So the role of these gatekeepers can affect what happens in the reporting.
Right. I mean, no, I'm trying to say that when you talk to the actual homeless people that are supposed to be benefited by a policy,
right,
I think you see the holes in the policy.
Great.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I think that's wonderful, Gail, because I found one of the things to avoid is when you're going to write about a policy issue, and you have to have a news hook if you're going to plunge in, don't just take the people they feed you. I try to go out and find my own homeless people, my own outreach workers, aside from the ones that, because they're going to find someone who fits their narrative that they want to present. And it's really important to try to be independent.
Let's talk to Alan in Richmond, who's calling into the program. Alan, welcome to your call.
Hi. Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. It suddenly broke loose. Anyway, I haven't seen all the articles by any means, but the one thing I see missing is that we always assume we can invent it best here, as opposed to when I was in Madrid in 1990, I saw exactly one person on the street in the whole town. And I spent quite a bit of time walking around. I found out that what they did, Madrid being a town with a lot of cobblestone streets and not possible to clean automatically with these big machines, they put people to work cleaning them. So every morning, like at 5 in the morning, they would go to these little places that were built into the walls of various buildings and pull out carts with two aluminum cans on it, brushes, you know, the whole paraphernalia, and they would clean up. And the Spanish are very, very messy people, by and large. They throw anything on the street, much more so than we do here. Yet they don't have a homeless problem.
So
why?
you're saying trying to look beyond our borders, perhaps, for approaches.
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of ideas all over the world.
Well, I'm sure that Kevin and Gail and Daniel probably at least have some kind of thought about this. Why don't you want to jump in and, you know, say what your thoughts are in terms of looking internationally for approaches?
I do have one comment. I talked to the UN rapporteur on homelessness for the world, who looks at homelessness around the world, this last week. She was reacting to what we were doing, and we were talking. I used to work over in Australia, New Zealand, England, Europe, and this isn't Madrid may have some, you know, good progress with that kind of program, but this is not a problem isolated to the United States. Homelessness and poverty is throughout the westernized world, at least. It's the old thing of when we catch a cold, everyone else catches the flu. I mean, it's employment programs, investment in housing, those things are lacking all over the world, not just here. And doing those approaches, like you're saying, employment programs, that's a fix. You have to ramp them up.
We are running short on time. That's the voice of Kevin Fagan, longtime reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. Also with us, Gail Holland from the Los Angeles Times, and from Seattle, Daniel Beekman, Seattle Times staff reporter. Before we go, obviously this has been, here in the Bay Area, a big week of coverage around issues of homelessness. Kevin Fagan, this is your beat. You're not going to be stopping working on these issues. What right now are you thinking, you know, what's the next thing you're moving to, and how are you thinking about kind of capitalizing on the momentum that's been created around this week?
Oh, I love the momentum. I do cover other things.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
This is a special concentration. I've got heaps of stories. I'm going to do something more regional. I want to go up and look at Seattle again. I've been up there before, but Daniel, I'm fascinated at the challenge up there. There's some real similarities we can learn from. L.A. has got some great funding initiatives oriented toward creating more housing. I want to go down and look at what's going on there. There are more stories you can shake a stick at.
Gail Holland, what are you going to be working on next?
I'm working currently on a lot on Skid Row and what's going on with Skid Row. I have a whole series of stories I'm doing. And as far as the international coverage, I'm sure my colleagues would join me in saying, we're ready. I'd love to go. I've, of course, had the same thoughts, and every city I go to, I'm like, where are the homeless people? And they're there. They, you know, Europe obviously has a whole different social safety net than we do. But I think it would be really valuable to go abroad and see what's going on.
Daniel Beekman, a brief final thought from you?
Sure. Well, something I'm going to be trying to look at in the next, well, for the rest of the year, is how our mayor and city council deal with next year's budget. The mayor has said he wants to make some changes in the way the city funds homeless services and be more outcomes-based in that spending. And so it'll be interesting to see what he does and how far he gets on that front.
Daniel, Gail, Kevin, thank you all for joining us. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks to everyone who called or emailed during the hour. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Agley here at Hart on the Your Call Media Roundtable. Thanks for listening. On the next Your Call, we are going to return to our conversation that Rose had with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice and author of the new book, The Fight to Vote. It took nearly two centuries to expand voting rights from property-owning white men to all Americans. But the hard-won battle is still on. 17 states have introduced new voting restrictions, ranging from strict voter ID laws to cutting back on early voting. How is this affecting voter turnout, and what will it take to protect the right to vote? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Jesse Seren's adult life is on hold.
Who could afford a wedding? Who could afford a house? Who could afford a child?
Because she has $90,000 in student loans. But while loans are holding back some grads, people who made those loans are getting rich.
Like, wow, you know, here's people making a lot of money off of this.
Find out who next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Reveal, Monday at 11 a.m., right after Your Call here on 91.7.
From body double to Carrie to the Untouchables, what shaped the mind that made those movies? Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo.
There was something about the way the story was told and the cinematic language used in it that connected to me, even though at that point I was studying to be an engineer.
Filmmaker Brian De Palma later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
3 o'clock this afternoon for All Things Considered here on KALW. San